Hello, I'm Peter Anthony Holder. This is number 0100, the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. And it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0100, our 100th show. Woohoo! And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Alan Beard, who is one of the co-creators of Historical Tweets. It started out as a website, became a book, then a desk calendar. It is its own little cottage industry. Did he think it would ever get this successful?
There was no goal at the beginning. We were working on a different project and thought the idea was funny, so we just went to work on it. We never thought anyone else would see it or that it would become anything beyond just an initial series of jokes. It, in the first couple of months, exceeded our expectations and continues to do so. So it's been really great.
David Friedlander is the author of The 12 Keys. He's on to talk about our relationships with our parents.
As long as you are holding on to blame or angry feelings at what your parents did or didn't do or any of that, you're really keeping yourself from having all the stuff that you want in life. Because as long as you're focused on what is not going right or what they did that was wrong for you, that is unfortunately building a case that supports something that's off or wrong in your life, which none of us really want anything to be off or wrong. So I would like to encourage people to let that statute expire and realize that all of our parents are just people who, no matter how good or how bad they are, most everyone's parents are at least doing the best they can.
Peter Franklin, the Gabby Cabby, shares a slice of the Big Apple from his yellow mobile conveyance lounge. He talks about many things, including Cleopatra's Needle, the New York Monument that's been there since 1881, and apparently Egypt wants it back.
Well, this was brought to New York many, many years ago, and the Egyptian government is now asking for it back. First of all, what Egyptian government are we dealing with? Because nobody's quite sure who's running Egypt. So even if we were to give it back, I don't know who we'd know to give it to.
Plus, there's lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0100, was me, Peter Anthony Holder. I like to do the guest slate, you know, every 100 shows. I did the first one. Although, technically speaking, if I do it every 100 shows, I should have done 101, but I just couldn't help myself. So, there you go. And I'd like to thank me for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Well, it seems you can buy almost anything from a vending machine these days, but a wedding? A company called Concept Shed has just unveiled a new vending machine that enables you to get married for just a dollar. The 8-foot-tall pink auto-wed machine is described by its makers as a parking meter mixed up with a Cadillac. After inserting your dollar bill, the machine plays a specially composed version of the wedding march. Customers are then able to select their type of union from gay, straight, lesbian, or best friends forever. The ceremony then takes place courtesy of a robotic voice, and customers confirm their vows by pressing one button for I do and another for escape. After inputting their names, the happy couple then gets a wedding receipt and two plastic rings. And just in case things don't work out, the machine also issues a 10% off voucher for auto divorce. The first auto wed machine has now been bought by Marvin's Marvelous Mechanical Museum in Framingham Hills, Michigan. Gee, why stop at a marriage or divorce machine? What about other family situations? A machine that helps to induce labor, perhaps? I think I'll stop short at a machine that performs circumcisions. Yeah. Meanwhile, in Russia, 32-year-old Viktor Jasinski made the very bad mistake of trying to rob a female hairdresser at gunpoint. But his intended victim turned the tables on him and allegedly beat him senseless, tied him up naked, and then used him as a sex slave for 3 days. After entering the hair salon and demanding all the money from the cash register, the store's owner, 28-year-old Olga Zajic, quickly took him down with her black belt karate skills. She then tied him up with a hairdryer cord, took him to a back room, stripped him naked, and then used him as a sex slave for 3 days to, quote, teach him a lesson, unquote. She eventually let him go, telling him, "Get out of my sight." Victor first went to the hospital to treat his swollen testicles, and then to the police, where he explained he had been held hostage in a back room at a hairdresser's, chained up naked with pink fluffy handcuffs to a radiator, and fed nothing but Viagra. When police arrived to question Olga, she reportedly said, "What a jerk. Yes, we had sex a couple of times, but I bought him new jeans, gave him food, and even gave him 1,000 rubles when he left." Well, they were both arrested. So, there you go. You know, to the guys in the audience, I know this is quite a disturbing story on a whole, but it's the fact that this woman had her own Viagra stash that I find truly alarming. Okay, let's talk a little bit about the Nazis, shall we? Or neo-Nazism, anyway. While it's never acceptable to judge a man by the color of his skin, it might sometimes be wise to judge him by the logo on his T-shirt. In Bayview, Idaho, 28-year-old neo-Nazi Darren Abbey threatened to stab 46-year-old Marlon Baker, who is black, in a local bar after telling him that blacks are not welcome here. Baker and his friend left the bar, but Abbey allegedly followed behind, shouting racial slurs. Then Baker says Abbey made a motion like he was going to do something. It might have been smart if the racist idiot would have taken time to notice the T-shirt that Baker was wearing, the one that proudly displayed the logo of the Spokane, Washington Boxing Club. In self-defense, Baker threw a single punch, knocking Abbey to the ground and rendering him unconscious. Abbey was later treated for a possible broken nose after police arrested him. He's being held on $75,000 bond on charges of battery and malicious harassment. What a moron. Although he doesn't quite make idiot of the day, but he could have been in the running. He could have been close. Anyway, speaking of Nazis, let's talk about the biggest Nazi of all time. That would be Hitler. A little bit of a history lesson here. It seems back during World War II, the French resistance and Allied bombers weren't the only threats Hitler's Nazi soldiers faced in Paris. Turns out, syphilis, spread from indulging French prostitutes, presented a much bigger problem, at least according to the new book Mussolini's Barber by author Graham Donald, which chronicles the most bizarre untold war stories. So anyway, to combat Nazi soldiers' temptations from the Parisian whores, Hitler gave the okay to manufacture blow-up sex dolls as a more, shall we say, hygienic alternative. The sex dolls were part of the Borgild Project, a top-secret 1940 mission inspired by SS Chief Heinrich Himmler, who first alerted Hitler of the syphilis problem. The project focused on creating smaller-than-life-size dolls that would fit into a soldier's backpack. As for design, they first approached Hungarian actress Kathy von Nagy to see if she would serve as a model for the doll. How atomically correct was the request for modeling going to be? Anyway, she refused, and the Nazis unsurprisingly opted for a blue-eyed blonde version to comfort their soldiers. But the project was quickly canned after soldiers refused to carry the dolls in fear of embarrassment if captured. Okay, I think we can all agree Hitler was crazy. Anyway, let's get to our first guest on the Stuff File program, shall we? And it's kind of connected because it's historical in nature. Ever wondered what historical figures like Abraham Lincoln or Gandhi would tweet about? At historicaltweets.com, curious history buffs can read fictional messages major figures, living or dead, would post on Twitter concerning famous events that involve them. On the line with us right now is Alan Beard, one of the co-creators of Historical Tweets. He joins us from California. Hi, Alan.
Hey, how are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for being on the program with us. The last time I spoke to you a couple of years ago was when things were just getting started with Historical Tweets, and now, 2 years later, there's a book, the site's getting bigger. How has this grown for you?
It's been
It's been really amazing and really fun. It's sort of taken on a life of its own, and we're just enjoying it as it goes along. The book came out last year in the U.S. and a British version that is coming out in the U.K. in the fall. And there's a 2012 desk calendar that's for sale now, and it's just been its own little engine that keeps going.
When you first started this, what was the goal at the time, and have you exceeded that, or are you on plan to do exactly what you thought you'd do?
There was no goal at the beginning. It was just that we were working on a different project and thought the idea was funny, so we just went to work on it. And we never thought anyone else would see it or that it would become anything beyond just an initial series of jokes. And it in the first couple of months exceeded our expectations and continues to do so. So it's been really great.
How many followers do you have on the website or on Twitter?
You know, there's several thousand on both. It's not something that we pay a ton of close attention to, those numbers, because really historical tweets has become just sort of one of our creative outlets personally, and it's been a driver really of interest in our main business, which is a social media creation for brands and companies.
Okay. Now, how often do you come up? I mean, you have the book, you have the desk calendars you mentioned, but how often do you come up with new tweets?
We tend to write them in big bunches. So rather than sort of set aside X amount of time per day to write a new one for the day, we'll set aside a day or two and write a whole bunch of them, and then produce them. Really, the driver more recently of writing new material has been the books that we signed on to do. Random House published it in the U.S. and Summersdale is doing it in the U.K. And then the calendar sounded like a fun idea. And then we should have done the math. The book itself had about 120 original historical tweets in it. And we was like, sure, we'll do a calendar. It'll be easy. And then we started thinking about it, and we ended up writing about three times as much material for the calendar as we did for the book. So it turned into a much bigger project. But we wrote all of that material over the course of a couple of weeks.
I believe at the time when I spoke to you on the old radio program, I said that this was one of those ideas that once you hear it, once you see it, you think, gosh, why didn't I think of that? It has grabbed the attention of so many people. I would also suspect that with the success of the website, you get people writing in, giving you ideas for historical tweets.
Yeah, that's been another really interesting part of it. We put the design template for historical tweets up on the site from the very beginning and encouraged people to send in their own. And, a lot of people did, created their own and sent them in. And even more people just email us directly and say, here's an idea. Or sometimes they say, you should do one about so-and-so. And they'll list some historical figure's name. And hope that we'll write one for that person, it's been a very interesting interactive process. Even some of the press outlets that have written about us have contributed their own, and that's been great too. So we've enjoyed the whole process, and in the book we even included a blank tweet the famous iconic picture of Richard Nixon standing with Elvis Presley in the White House. We included that photo in the book with a blank space underneath it for people to write their own and send them in to us. So that process has been great, and we even a couple of our fans who contributed things to the site. We even included a couple of their tweets in the calendar with their permission, of course.
Are there any people in history, any famous tweeters, as it were, who seem to garner more attention or more interest in hearing or reading their tweets than others?
Definitely. Abraham Lincoln continues to be among all the U.S. presidents, the most seemingly followed and retweeted and has garnered the most interest. Part of it is that he, for so many reasons, is considered sort of one of the best and most famous presidents. One of the tweets that we wrote for him, which is the one where he tweets out, anybody got a more creative way of saying 87 years? The little joke riff on the opening to the Gettysburg Address 47 years ago.
You have no idea, by the way.
That one has gone far and wide among fans of the book, and even some celebrities retweeted that one, and it's gotten us a lot of attention.
Well, you have no idea how many times I have quoted that particular tweet. It's funny you bring that one up.
Yeah, it's just when you see that one, you know, so many people use Twitter in that sort of casual communication method. They sending out a request for ideas or information to their friends. The idea of Abraham Lincoln doing that the night before the Gettysburg Address is just sort of inherently funny, I think, to people who are big fans of his, and to people who don't really consider themselves fans but know that phrase and know his stuff. More infamously, our Gandhi tweet has gotten a lot of both positive and a lot of negative attention. The India Times sort of denounced us after we wrote the tweet where Gandhi tweets, going on a diet, want to get back into my skinny jeans. And that, of course, some people think that's really funny because, he is obviously a skinny guy for reasons other than wanting to get into his jeans, but also just sort of considered blasphemous by some people because he's Gandhi and you don't joke about Gandhi, but I guess we do.
I remember when we spoke 2 years ago, that was still in the news. Has the Times of India calmed down, or is it all water under the Ganges, as it were?
I think that they found other fish to fry, but
okay.
It's one of those that people always refer to as one of those that sticks out to them as skewering the sacred cow, as it were.
I mentioned the Abraham Lincoln one, which I always quote to other people mentioning your site. That's my favorite. My second favorite is Rosa Parks.
Yeah, it's all of these you can read them multiple ways. Of course, Rosa Parks is obviously someone who is held up in high regard by nearly everyone in the world for the sort of pivotal role she played, and a joke like that is only funny because she is so revered. Same with Gandhi, really. It isn't a funny joke if you don't accept that he is really highly respected. And so the Rosa Parks one is another one that some people think is inappropriate to make any joke about her. But I think that one in particular sort of honors her while also being funny.
And we should mention the actual tweet is, "You want me to do what? Oh, hell no."
Right.
I love it. The book has been out for a while now. Are you following up with another book? I know you say it's coming out in the UK in the fall.
Yeah, so the UK book is, although it'll be out under the same title, is a slightly different book. For the British audience, the publishers in the UK wanted us to rework it a little bit, take out some of the ones that were so very American, the baseball jokes and some of the other figures that were less well known to British and European audiences. And we wrote new ones that are more focused on the historical figures that got less treatment in the original book, but that we think the UK audiences will enjoy.
The book is great. The website is great. It's historicaltweets.com is the website. You could also find it on Twitter, of course. And the book is called Historical Tweets. I thank you very much, Alan, for taking the time to talk with us.
Oh, you're welcome.
Alan Beard, one of the guys behind Historical Tweets. Again, you can find the website at historicaltweets.com, and you could also go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0100, and you'll find links to the website and also links to amazon.com, where you can order the book directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick. If you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
You're listening to The Stuff File program. It's the choice of 4 out of 5 dentists. The 5th dentist also listens, but that's just because he follows the crowd. Here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll try to stop blaming our parents. Plus, Peter Franklin, the Gabby Cabby, shares a slice of the Big Apple from his yellow mobile conveyance lounge. And, of course, there is an idiot of the day. And lots more Stuff File news right here, right now. In Woodridge, Virginia, apparently 28-year-old U.S. Army officer Justin Dale Little Jim just couldn't wait to enjoy his sex shop burglary goodies until he got home. When officers arrived on the scene, a police dog led them to a closet where they allegedly found Little Jim attempting sexual relations with a blow-up doll. Jerry Poe, manager of the MVC Late Night Shop, said, "It's sad. Our stuff is reasonably priced. Anyone can come in here and purchase it." Little Jim has been charged with burglary, grand larceny, and destruction of property for the incident, and we're assuming his Army career is pretty much done. You know, he's that desperate for sex that he's got to steal a sex toy, and he's going to jail. That is not a winning combination. Anyway, in Garden Grove, California, police have arrested 48-year-old Catherine Kiu Becker, an apparently very angry woman. She allegedly drugged her husband, cut off his penis, then threw it into the garbage disposal, and then turned the disposal on. When officers arrived at the scene, they found a man bleeding from the crotch area. Mrs. Becker allegedly put an unknown drug into her husband's food to make him sleepy. She then tied him to the bed. When he woke up, she cut off his penis with a knife, then tossed the penis in the garbage disposal, and as I said, turned it on. The victim was rushed to the hospital where he underwent emergency surgery and is listed in serious condition, you figure. Investigators say the couple was married but going through a divorce. Mrs. Becker has been charged with aggravated mayhem, false imprisonment, assault with a deadly weapon, administering a drug with intent to commit a felony, poisoning, and spousal abuse. She is currently being held at the Orange County Jail. I think that divorce will be quickly granted. And apparently she didn't want the divorce, but I'm beginning to see why maybe he wanted the divorce. She's nuts. Anyway, nobody is quite sure why, but outside the Bed Bath & Beyond store in Radnor Township, Pennsylvania, an employee leaving the store found a bag containing what police estimate to be about 35 pounds of human vomit. More amazingly, this was the second such bag found in the same spot. The first was found about a week earlier. Radnor Township police are investigating, but really don't have much to go on, and probably the only crime here is littering. Okay, as odd as this story seems to be, let's analyze this for a second, shall we? It's not that a huge bag of vomit was found, because Lord knows that's weird enough. It's the fact that the bag contains 35 pounds of human vomit. What are the chances of 35 pounds of anything being expelled from one human being? You see what I'm getting here? We seem to have a gaggle of gaggers here. That's the mystery to this story. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, authorities in Ohio, responding to reports of a domestic dispute, said a woman sprayed them with her breast milk while they were attempting to detain her. The Delaware County Sheriff's Office said they were called to the Bridgewater Banquet and Conference Center on a report of a domestic dispute, and a woman there told them that he was attending a wedding with his wife, who he said became drunk and struck him multiple times. County Sheriff Walter Davis III said the woman, Stephanie Robinette, age 30, of Westerville, had locked herself in a car and deputies attempted to coax her out, but she was uncooperative. When deputies attempted to remove Robinette from the vehicle, she advised the deputies that she was a breastfeeding mother and proceeded to remove her right breast from her dress and began spraying deputies and the vehicle with her milk. Davis said Robinette was arrested and charged with domestic violence, assault, obstructing official business, resisting arrest, and disorderly conduct. So, she was arrested. Well, that's tit for tat, isn't it? Yes. She's a mother, which means somewhere down the road, her child, be it a boy or a girl, will probably spend some time complaining about their mother. Which kind of leads us to the next guest on the Stuff File program. You know, we're always hearing experts say that our current problems in life are largely caused by our relationship with our parents, but is that actually true? Isn't there some way to rewire or overcome the past? If we had a difficult relationship as children, are we really doomed to failure? Well, joining us right now is motivational speaker and author David Friedlander. He's the author of The 12 Keys, How to Unlock Your Full Potential and Live the Life of Your Dreams. Hi, David.
Hey, how you doing, Peter? Glad to be on your show.
Thanks for joining us. I'm doing well. I remember back in the late 80s, there was a very popular television show on ABC called 30-something, and I remember the premiere episode, there was a line in that show that I never forgot, and that is, just how long is the statute of limitations on parental war crimes?
Well, I hope it's getting shorter by the day. I hope that people, I hope that what my book is putting out there and other people are offering is that the sooner you get over it, the sooner that that statute of limitations expires, the sooner you get to really move on to your own life. Because as long as you are holding on to blame or angry feelings at what your parents did or didn't do or any of that, you're really keeping yourself from having all the stuff that you want in life. Because as long as you're focused on what is not going right or what they did that was wrong for you, that is unfortunately building a case that supports something that's off or wrong in your life, which none of us really want anything to be off or wrong. So I would like to encourage people to let that statute expire and realize that all of our parents are just people who, no matter how good or how bad they are, most everyone's parents are at least doing the best they can.
Is part of the problem, the abundance of media we've had in the last 30 years or so, and by that I mean We watch movies. There are sitcoms. There's more and more books out there, and we seem to be wanting to compare what we had or didn't have with our parents to others, be they real or fictional.
Oh, I think absolutely. I think that the media, and part of what I think is going to be a great opportunity in the new world paradigm, the future that I'm working towards, is that we're going to use our media more responsibly. I think that, again, television and movies has been, they're a great thing. They have great potential to communicate huge messages, and unfortunately, a lot of the messages that have been communicated so far have been regarding what to feel bad over and what's okay, and just because everybody else is blaming their parents or blaming other people or feeling let down or left out or whatever, jumping on that bandwagon is not necessarily the most healthy or best thing. I think there's an epidemic of it, certainly in North America, wanting to blame the government and blame your company and blame your parents. It just, come on. There is a truth that individually we are responsible for our lives, that when we understand, our lives become a lot more fun and become a lot more in our power. As long as we're thinking that our lives are at the mercy of our jobs or our government or all kinds of other people, then we're really taking what is naturally ours, what is our right, and we're giving it away to all kinds of other people. And I think, yes, the media has, I don't think it's been intentional, but I think it certainly has had a large impact. And I think, don't compare yourself to other people you see on TV. Compare yourself to what is the ideals in your mind of your best life.
They're not always the same. So how do you go about, what's the first step or the biggest step in breaking that cycle?
Well, I would say, first of all, you can buy my book, or you can even get it free online at www.thesolid.com. You can, honestly, I'm giving you my book. You can download it for free. You can listen to the ebook for free, because I want to get this information out there. So I'd say that's probably the easiest. But if you're just listening to this interview and you don't go to the site or you don't buy the book or anything, I would say the easiest thing is, number one, have an open mind. Be open to the fact that maybe you're closer to the things that you want than you think, and maybe your parents or maybe somebody didn't do you as wrong as you think. And just because you have a case for it built up in your mind, maybe there's a new perspective. Just considering that maybe there's another perspective to see your situation from often will open up that new perspective. But so many people are so committed to their belief and to the case that they're building for, you know, what's the matter and how they've been done wrong, that they keep on seeing that story. So I'm saying that there is lots of different stories possible, and that people who are really successful, hugely successful individuals, they let go of that stuff and they move forward focusing on their life. So I would encourage you to have, do, and be everything that you want in your life. Really being successful eliminates blame. It eliminates excuses. When you're really doing what you want in your life, you're not, you don't have excuses for why you're doing it. You're not blaming other people. You're just celebrating it. And it's only when you're not accomplishing at the level that you really want, having, doing, being what you want, relationship-wise, financially, material, everything, then you can find excuses and point blame. But that's not, again, the solution. So I'd say the solution is, what do you really want in life? And then learn how to focus on and keep your mind resonating on those things. And that's what I'm teaching in my book, The 12 Keys, and making as simple as possible for people to receive.
And you mentioned the website, which is thesolid.com. And I should mention that solid is spelled with a Y, so that's SOLYD.com.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, no problem.
For clarifying.
What I find very interesting, I'm not a parent. Mm-hmm. But what I find very interesting are there are some people out there who, even when they become parents, most people, when they become parents, get it, because they think back to when they were kids, they think back to what their parents did or didn't do, and they realize when they become parents themselves, they're not perfect. No one can be. The thing I don't understand are the people who become parents and still don't get it.
Well, you know, there is no statute of limitations on limited-mindedness or narrow thinking, unfortunately. And just because a person in age might be 65 years old, they still might have – I have some family members. I won't mention any specific names, but I have people in my own family who I hear complain about other family members, literally, who are 60-plus years old, complaining about other family members who are literally 90-something years old. And I'm saying to myself, are you serious? Oh, really? this is the best use of your time or your energy or your mind. So just because you have kids or just because you have grandkids, that doesn't necessarily mean that you have grown wise. You would hope so, but not in everybody's case.
What made you write this book in the first place, the 12 Keys? Was there a situation that you saw? Was there a time when, shall we say, push came to shove and you said, you know, I need to get this information out there?
Yeah, absolutely. I personally, I moved to New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina as a contractor doing construction work, and I had an amazing experience. I still have a place there, and I love the people of New Orleans. And my business started to go extremely well. I started to make a real lot of money, and I started to have a much smoother, much better, much happier life experience than I'd had, not just because of the money, that was one thing, but on all cylinders. My relationships improved, my life had just improved in a dramatic way, and it was all because of things that I was doing intentionally, that I was learning from all kind of books that I was reading, all kind of different self-help books and philosophical books and other business people who have been successful. And I just decided that I wanted to test in my life, how far can I go? How high can I make it? Where can I go to? And for me personally, what I learned was that the things that were holding me back, the only reason that I wasn't more successful earlier is because of a lot of stuff mentally, a lot of ideas that I was holding and a lot of orientations that I had towards the world and perspectives. And that literally, when I changed the way that I was thinking about the world and I started to learn some new ideas about how to set goals, how to be a visionary, how to be allowing of other people to just do what they're doing and not let it bother me, things that I didn't really know in the past, but I learned from dozens, hundreds of different books, my life started to become like a dream. It really started to become like magic. And I said to myself, this is incredible. My parents don't know this. He didn't teach me this. There's a few really smart, really wealthy people in the world who then turn around and write books and say, hey, do you want to know what made me so successful? For example, Richard Branson, also the guy that owns the New Orleans Hornets. He actually recently sold the team, but he's the founder of the New Orleans Hornets. He barely finished high school. Richard Branson's a high school dropout. John Paul DeJoria, the owner of Paul Mitchell Hair Care Products and Patron Tequila, high school dropout. Owner of Dole Foods, David Burdock, high school dropout. And all those guys have taught me extremely valuable lessons in my life, and I talk about them all in the book. And so for me, I'm 33 years old right now, and I wrote this book just in the last couple of years. I said, you know what, I want to get this information out there. I especially want to teach it to young people because I don't really see that many motivational speakers or authors aimed at high school, college-age, young adults trying to find their direction in life. And because I'm a young person who's struggled in every which way earlier in life and then learned how to really get my life into harmony, I just want to teach as many people as possible that it's possible and spread the word. I want to be the change in the world that I want to see. So that's what made me write the book.
David, very quickly, because we're just running out of time, are your parents still alive?
They certainly are.
And what's your relationship like with them? Have there been difficult times, and have you gotten past those?
Oh, yeah. There's been tons of difficult times. I mean, when I was young, trust me, I blamed my parents for all kinds of stuff, and that was part of the miracle that happened in my life, was learning to see them as people and just live and let live, that they were doing their best, they were young, and then when I realized that, it allowed me to see the good that they did. It allowed me to see the food that they put on the table, the clothes they put on my back, and the love that they gave me to the best of their ability, and that healed and improved our relationship dramatically, and you know what? They didn't change. It was me. So when I learned to change the way that I was looking at my relationship with them and what they had done or hadn't done or any of that, I immediately began to see value that I didn't used to see. And that improved my relationship with them a lot because I started to acknowledge that even if they haven't done everything in the world right and everything great for me, they've done some things right and they've done plenty of good things for me. So when I started to acknowledge that and not even necessarily tell them that, just acknowledging my own mind, it improved our relationship dramatically, and I have a great relationship with my father and my stepmother and my biological mom, all of them, great relationships. And that's I wish the same for everybody, and it's possible. It's doable.
The book is called The 12 Keys, How to Unlock Your Full Potential and Live the Life of Your Dreams. It's written by David Friedlander, and you can check out his website at thesolid.com. David, I thank you very, very much for being on the program with us.
Peter, it's my pleasure, and everybody listening, thank you so much, and God bless.
David Friedlander, author of The 12 Keys, How to Unlock Your Full Potential and Live the Life of Your Dreams. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0100, and you'll find links to David's website. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. You know, we often have on this program at this moment a segment called Let's Be Fair from Bob Dorigo Jones. And it just so happens on this, our 100th show, we have his 100th edition of Let's Be Fair. So here it is.
I'm Bob Dorigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. In President Reagan's farewell address, he said, and I quote, "Let me offer lesson number one about America. All great change in America begins at the dinner table. So tomorrow night in the kitchen, I hope the talking begins." End of quote. In my first 99 episodes of Let's Be Fair, we've taken sharp aim at frivolous lawsuits and the challenges that face our court system. We often try to do it in a humorous way with the hope that maybe a story or two will make it to your dinner table. I believe that if we talk about the problems we face, then maybe we can figure out a few ways to solve them together. Let's be fair, we live in a country that attracts people from around the world because we have the freest society on earth, and we have a court system that protects my right to say whatever I like. So in our 100th episode of Let's Be Fair, let me say this. Thank you for tuning in each week. And tonight at the dinner table, let the talking continue. To learn more, visit centerforamerica.org.
Latitude, 47 degrees, 14 minutes north. Longitude, 84 degrees, 39 minutes west. Location, Montreal, Canada. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Now, the Stuff File presents the Gabby Cabby, direct from his yellow mobile conveyance lounge in the city that never sleeps, New York. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
Hello, Mr. Franklin, sir. How are you?
I am just fine. Hello, hello, hello again. Shaboom, shaboom.
Yeah, da 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 da. There you go. I want to start off by talking a little bit about a big event that took place in your neck of the woods, and that is Derek Jeter hitting number 3,000. Also, he did it with a monster home run. And you have some thoughts about that and some memories of Yankee Stadium, indeed?
Yeah, well, actually, Yankee Stadium is at 161st Street and River Avenue in the Bronx, which is one of the five boroughs of the city of New York. I grew up at 163rd and the Grand Concourse, which really is just a few blocks away. So as kids, we really used to hang around the stadium on days that were games and what have you. And as a matter of fact, in those days, after it got to be about the sixth inning, which is roughly about half the game or so, they'd let the kids in for nothing. Can you imagine that happening today? No way. So, you know, we'd see all the famous baseball players and what have you. And as a matter of fact, as many of us got older and were teenagers, we would then work in the park selling popcorns and peanuts and Cracker Jacks. So I have some very pleasant memories. As far as Jeter hitting the home run and making the 3,000th, I think it's wonderful. I personally think they kind of, how shall I put this tactfully, because I'm about the only person who has said it publicly, I think the pitcher may have dumped it a little bit.
Actually, you know, you're not the first person I've heard who said that, but I then heard somebody else who watched the replay and saw the reaction of the pitcher and figured, no, it didn't look that way. He was steadfastly saying that the pitcher did his best and didn't want to give that monster hit to Jeter. I mean, let's face it, there's a way of giving him the 3,000th hit without him parking it in deep left center field.
If you think so, Peter.
I'm not buying into all these conspiracy theories, sir.
It's not a question of a conspiracy. It's a question of, you know, it's almost as good to be the guy who threw the pitch. Now, let me think, and I know you have a worldwide audience, so I'm about to name a name that none of your listeners will even know what I'm talking about, but every person of my generation, including you, will know when I say the words Ralph Branca.
Ralph Branca?
Yes.
Didn't he give up the shot heard around the world?
Exactly. Which made him, he was the one who was pitching the ball to Bobby Thompson, who hit the home run so that the Giants, and New York Giants in those days, could beat the Brooklyn Dodgers. You can see how old that is because there is no longer the New York Giants and there's no longer the Brooklyn Dodgers. No, I'm not saying that Derek Jeter isn't a great baseball player, but I think, you know, there was a tendency there to just give him the 3,000 hit, get it over and done with. It was a home game, meaning they were playing it at Yankee Stadium rather than some godforsaken other place, and it was over and done with. As far as the pitcher's look, mannerism, listen, that's something called acting. You know, you can get that in any school. You haven't lived until you've seen my performance after I pitch a ball to Derek Jeter.
Okay. He did go 5-for-5 in that game, by the way, so he's not the only hit he had that day. He had a monster day all the way around.
Right, and how often does that happen?
Okay. Now, one of the other stories, apparently they're rationing toilet paper in your fair burg.
Listen, with 8.5 million people, you can imagine how much toilet paper can be used. Well, you can't regulate it and what somebody's using in their own home, I guess. But what they're doing is at the parks where they have public bathrooms, they're actually having one of the attendants hand out pieces of toilet paper according to, whatever the regulation is, let's say 4 or 5 sheets. I know it sounds absolutely ridiculous, and it's a dumb way to try to save money, but I guess it does save some money. People should do, here's a travel advisory, do what we always did in the Army, and as a matter of fact, we still do when we travel now. Take a look at your own toilet paper. You don't want to be found short.
Yeah, I'm sure they'll stop that when they'll stop rationing it when they have that first outbreak of cholera.
Or the plague.
Meanwhile, there's a crime afoot in New York City that seems to be growing, and that is people stealing strollers, expensive strollers.
Yeah, well, we call them strollers. They're called prams in other parts of the world. They're very, very expensive, especially in New York City, where people will pay $700-$800 to have them. I mean, it's sort of like a status symbol. I mean, you'll find more expensive strollers in New York City than you're going to find Mercedes and Rolls Royces. But the thing is that most of the people in this world live in houses, and that's a house that has a driveway and a lawn and a backyard. So the thought of leaving your stroller, your baby stroller, in front of your house while you go inside to get some more milk or something is not such an earth-shaking deal. But when you're living in an apartment house, you can't leave your stroller in front of the apartment house and go upstairs to the 16th floor to get some more provisions and then come down and expect to see a $900 stroller still sitting there. And I must know what I'm talking about because the police department has announced that it happens to be the fastest growing crime in New York City. Luckily, no one has taken one yet with a kid in it, which would be quite a shocking surprise. But you just, in New York City, you have to, well, any big city, I guess, you got to live a little bit different than you might in a smaller town. They say we're more civilized, but in many ways, big cities aren't.
Well, they're very expensive, and they happen to be on wheels. It's just too much of a temptation for some people, I guess.
And they're easy to resell because, like so many other things, criminals could not make their living if it wasn't for the fact that so many people will go out and buy it. I mean, you're about to have a kid. Somebody comes along and says they can give you a $900 stroller for $400. And unfortunately, that's the temptation that the Lord put upon all of us.
Meanwhile, I understand the Cleopatra's Needle, somebody wants it to go home. For those who don't know what Cleopatra's Needle is, it sort of looks like a miniature version of the Washington Monument.
Yeah, I think they call it an obelisk.
Yeah.
But in any event, it was obtained like so many other artifacts were. The Brits did it, we did it, a lot of other, I'm presuming maybe even Canadians did it. We would go over to Egypt and you'd kind of take anything you want out of the tombs, out of the country, and bring it back to your own museum. Well, this was brought to New York many, many years ago, and the Egyptian government is now asking for it back. Now, the two things that are curious about that is, first of all, what Egyptian government are we dealing with? Because nobody's quite sure who's running Egypt. So even if we were to give it back, I don't know who we'd know to give it to. In addition to that, they're saying that it's being destroyed by New York's acid rain. Well, that's kind of silly because New York has now reached a point where really nothing is manufactured in New York City at all. The one thing we don't have in New York City, and we're very lucky in not having it, is pollution of that sort. As a matter of fact, the very little pollution that we have in New York City is blown east out into the Atlantic Ocean and, contaminating anybody who's that away. So it's a silly kind of a story. I don't think the Egyptian government, whoever it is, should hold their breath until they think we're giving it back to them.
And finally, there is a new museum in New York, in Long Island to be exact, that is dedicated to the history of elevators?
Yeah, well, I mean, listen, New York City, is in many ways almost the home of the elevator. The first elevator really manufactured was in Yonkers, which is the community just slightly north of New York City. The first building in the United States that had an elevator was the Cooper Union, which is an engineering school in Greenwich Village on Astor Place. So we certainly have more elevators than anybody else. And as a matter of fact, we're one of the few places left in the world where you have elevator operators. How many people have ever seen, in this day and age, somebody standing in an elevator and saying, "What floor, madam?" So they set up a history of elevators. It's at a museum which is in Queens. I would highly recommend it. We took a look at it. Very, very interesting. But you know, Peter, you got to remember one thing. When you're an elevator operator, it certainly has its ups and downs.
Absolutely. And on that note, the museum in Long Island is one of the many things you can see in New York. And maybe you might want to give a shout out to Peter Franklin, the Gabby Cabby. You can check out his website at www.gabby.com, or you can email him at peter@gabby.com. Maybe even arrange a tour, perhaps.
Yes, very nice. And thank you for saying that.
And thank you, sir, for being on the program with us once again.
Okay, bye-bye.
The Stuff File.
And we're almost at a racetrack on this edition of the Stuff File program. We have the Idiot of the Day coming up in just a moment, but first, one more Stuff File news story. Talk about employee loyalty. In China, 10 workers pushed their boss's car 3 miles home after an office party because they were all too drunk to drive. At the party, boss Xiang Fei announced that he was too drunk to drive, and suddenly everyone realized nobody had stayed sober enough to drive him home. As of this year, drunk driving in China was upgraded to a hazardous crime, and offenders face up to 6 months in jail and a heavy fine. Mr. Xiang didn't want to leave his car downtown, so company vice president Huang Wei-yun suggested that they all push him home, saying that the exercise would do them good. Passers-by were stunned to see the group laughing and singing as they pushed their boss's VW through the city streets during the 45-minute journey. Police said that as long as the car's engine was not running, it would not be classified as drunk driving under Chinese law. Okay, so the question is, who gets Employee of the Month here? That's what I want to know. Anyway, let's get to our last story of the program, and that, of course, is always the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the Strange Things Adults Do. This Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
In Durango, Colorado, 19-year-old Sean Ogden gets our Bonehead of the Day award. The teen was seriously injured after he got the bright idea to put various fireworks into a coffee grinder in an attempt to mix them and create one colossal firework. Well, guess what? The mixture blew up, and the ensuing explosion actually shook houses a quarter of a mile away. Ogden was taken to hospital, suffering from severe burns and other critical injuries. Okay, admittedly, I was pretty horrible at high school science, but a few things did sink in. And what I didn't glean from those classes, I certainly picked up by way of the errors of Wile E. Coyote. So why didn't any of this sink into our friend Sean, and why did he try to make a fireworks smoothie in a coffee grinder? One reason and one reason only. He's an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0100. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, where you'll find information and links and all of our guests by going to the Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and again, it's 0100. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com, and stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. And you can find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check out our Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, aboard China Airlines, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Show number 100. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Let me leave you with these words of wisdom. Never, ever juggle ice picks while standing on your waterbed.